It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, from 1984 to The Handmaid's Tale, there are a lot of scary visions of the future out there. We'll hear about an effort to create positive science fiction that could be a realistic roadmap for humankind.
First, all eyes are on Europe as President Trump prepares to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin tomorrow. They'll meet at the G20 summit in Germany.
The meeting follows Trump's speech to a friendly crowd in Poland, describing a clash of civilizations. He talked about defending Western values in the face of terrorism. Here's a listen.
The fundamental question of our time is whether the West has the will to survive. Do we have the confidence in our values to defend them at any cost? Do we have enough respect for our citizens to protect our borders? Do we have the desire and the courage to preserve our civilization in the face of those who would subvert and destroy it?
The president's visit, including the meeting with Putin, is raising questions about just how Trump will work with key NATO allies. It also raises questions about future U.S.-Russia relations as investigations into ties with the Kremlin continue at home.
Charles Kupchan joins us now. He's a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University and senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Charles, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Let's start with the president's appearance there in Poland, talking about Western values, the need to defend them. Was that an attempt to show interest in working with European allies, a sense of solidarity building there?
It was. You know, this was President Trump's second bite at the apple. He went to Europe a couple of weeks ago, and it went over with a thud, in part because he didn't affirm what's called Article 5, which is the U.S. commitment via NATO to collective defense. And he soon thereafter pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement. And the Chancellor of Germany went off and said, geez, we can't rely on our friends like we used to. Maybe Europe has to take its destiny into its own hands. So I think today's visit in Poland was an effort to undo some of the damage that was done. He did reaffirm America's commitment to collective defense. He did talk about Atlantic solidarity. Exactly which Western values he wants to reaffirm remains unclear, because like the government of Poland, his government veers in a somewhat illiberal direction when it comes to some of the traditional Western values of open media what you might call speaking truth rather than obfuscating the truth. But it was something that many Europeans, particularly in Poland, will be happy to hear.
Let's talk about that setting of Poland. I think it was Donald Rumsfeld back in the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, who talked about old Europe, you know, Western Europe, they don't like us as much anymore. But new Europe, places like Poland, they're our friends for the United States. Is there a more enthusiastic reception for President Trump in a place like Poland than in Western Europe?
No question. The Polish electorate has put in power a law and justice party that veers to the right. It's nationalist, it's populist, shares a lot of common ground with Donald Trump on issues of, let's say, coal mining, on issues of trying to slow down, if not halt, immigration. And so he got a warmer reception in Poland than he will get at the G20 in Hamburg. It's also the case that the government bust in some people who were supportive of Trump, because like in the United States, the urban dwellers tend to be more liberal center left, the rural dwellers more conservative and center right. But in general, Poland is still a very pro-American country. And in that respect, Trump did go to a place where he got a warm welcome.
The president, as we mentioned, is meeting with Russian President Putin. Western Europe watching that carefully, of course. But also, is Poland, places like that, closer to the Russian border, do they have mixed feelings about the president's relationship with Vladimir Putin?
Well, I think Poland and its neighbors, they're more comfortable now than they were a few months ago, because the president, as a candidate, and then soon after taking power, talked about NATO as being obsolete, was reluctant about affirming the collective defense commitment, talked about throwing Ukraine under the bus. And over the last few months, he's taken a much more conventional position. He met with Petro Poroshenko, the Ukrainian president. The administration applied new sanctions against Russia for its actions in Ukraine. He went to Poland today, which is a frontline state, if you will, and he called out Russia for its destabilizing activities. So I don't think it's going to be a very easy conversation tomorrow between Trump and Putin. And certainly the swirl that's continuing in Washington over Russian interference in the election here and what role the Trump campaign may have played in that interference, that is a difficult backdrop for the meeting.
Talking to Charles Kupchan right now from Georgetown University and the Council on Foreign Relations, looking at the president's visit to Europe, the G20 summit, his upcoming meeting with Russian President Putin. Let's focus in on that meeting with Vladimir Putin. What do we know about how this meeting is being set up? Who's at the table? How open it's going to be, if they're going to talk to press, anything like that?
Well, we hear that Putin asked for a one-on-one with no one else in the room except the interpreters, and that seems to have been walked back in favor of a larger meeting. There are two options. One would be to have what's called a pull-aside, and that would be a fairly small and a short meeting, maybe three aside, including the leaders and the interpreters. Or you could go for a full-on bilateral meeting, more formal, more people at the table, lasts longer. My understanding is that they have gone for that last option. That, number one, elevates the meeting. It makes it longer and more substantive. Two, it puts more people at the table. And we do know that Trump's advisors did not want him alone with Putin. They want to make sure that they hear the conversation. They want to make sure that everything that's discussed is accurately heard. I don't know if there is going to be a press conference. My guess is that there would not be. I'm expecting this meeting to really be about relationship building, trying to forge a bond between the two leaders. We haven't really seen much homework done in the past few weeks between Russians and Americans on Syria, on Ukraine, on hacking, the kind of spade work that you would need if one were to be hopeful that there would be a concrete deliverable out of the meeting.
Right. If I were drawing up an agenda, I could put things like North Korea, Syria, Ukraine, the Crimea part of the Ukraine, Russian threats to Western Europe, the interference you just mentioned, U.S. sanctions on Russia. This doesn't sound like the kind of meeting that's going to be a comprehensive look at all that stuff.
I agree. I mean, that's a great list that you just put out. And I hope that they get to at least some of it. I think Syria and Ukraine are the two issues on the top of the agenda. North Korea also, although that probably will get addressed more with Xi Jinping, the leader of China, than it will with Mr. Putin. But I do worry that in part because the Trump administration doesn't have its high-level people in place, it's just not been able to do the homework to get the people that they need to deal with this issue.
We're talking to Charles Kupchan, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, looking at President Trump's trip to Europe and his upcoming planned meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
And you can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of President Trump's recent speech in Poland? And are you hoping to see him work closely with European allies? What do you want to see come out of the president's meeting with Vladimir Putin? And how do you think it should be approached? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. We're picking up our conversation with Charles Kupchan, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, looking at President Trump's trip to Europe and upcoming meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
And you can join our conversation. Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Also post on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think about President Trump's call to defend Western values? Do you think the president should be forging stronger ties with European allies? And do you think that the president will have a meaningful conversation conversation with Russian President Vladimir Putin, and what do you think the risks are there? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Charles, as I understand it, you've been at the table at one point with former President Obama and Vladimir Putin. What is it like being in a negotiating room with the Russian president?
Well, the meeting that you're referring to was at the G20 in China late in 2016. And there, most of the conversation was about, as we were talking about a second ago, Syria and Ukraine. In that case, John Kerry, the Secretary of State, had basically been talking till he was blue in the face with Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, to try to get a deal on Syria, a political settlement, and hopefully... I think President Obama was hoping we'd close that deal in the meeting with Putin in China. It didn't happen. Putin is a very wily guy. You never quite know what you're getting. He's also a pro, so you have to be very careful in meetings with him. But I think that the core problem with Mr. Putin is that he has essentially attached his legitimacy to standing up to the West, to doing things like going into Ukraine and supporting Assad. And given that he doesn't have much else to sort of lean on when it comes to his political power in Russia, it's been very hard to get cooperation from him. And that's why I think President Trump has been a little bit naive when he thinks that he's going to be able to carve out some kind of bromance with this guy.
Are there places where there are common interests between the United States and Russia and the leaders thereof where there could be maybe even a small area to work together and maybe develop a small level of trust?
I think that's the way you have to go. You have to start small and try to build enough common ground that you can take the next step. And I would probably put Syria at the top of the list. And that's in part because Assad, for better or for worse, has made significant gains on the battlefield with the help of Russia and Iran, and to some extent Turkey, which has been a part of that dialogue. And so I think it's time for the United States to find some way of working with those parties in a way to bring the conflict to an end. We have different views about Assad's future than does Russia. But at the same time, I think both the Russians and the Americans and all the parties would like to see the conflict come to an end, would like to focus military efforts against ISIL, because ISIL poses a threat to all of us. So I would probably start there. That's where I think the common interests are going to be easiest to uncover.
I want to go back to Western Europe and our longtime allies there. You wrote recently after the president's previous visit to Europe that we may be seeing a big change in the Atlantic Alliance, where we had seen decades of sacrificing maybe your country's interest in the short run for the long-term peace and stability. We're moving back to more of an old school, a World War I style mentality. Can you talk about that a little more?
Yeah, the Trump administration doesn't seem to put a lot of stock in the idea of an Atlantic community of democracies with deeper roots, with a kind of institutionalized social core that that essentially holds us together. And in fact, right after that last trip to Europe, the Trump administration pulled out of the climate agreement, the Paris Climate Agreement, one of only two other countries, Syria and Nicaragua, that had not joined up. And then there was an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that basically said, this is a dog-eat-dog world where each nation is out for itself. And that's a very different kind of approach to global affairs than we've seen from every president from World War II on. And that has led to a situation in where the Western Europeans are really questioning whether we are still by their side. And I'm guessing that the conversation that took place between German Chancellor Merkel and President Trump about an hour ago was not a very pleasant conversation, because she's the host of the G20. She's got to put out some kind of statement at the end. Normally, that statement represents a consensus position of all the members. But when you have an America that is basically broken with the mainstream on climate, basically doesn't share the view of Europeans on refugees and immigration, seems to be backing away from free trade, it's going to be very hard to find common ground.
And you also wrote in that piece about what kind of course Germany and other European Union nations could chart now, given that they don't necessarily think they can rely on the United States. What do you see in their future?
Well, this may be Europe's moment. Despite the fact that the United Kingdom is in the process of exiting from the European Union, the elections in France brought to power a very pro-European member, somebody who really wants to invest in European integration. And it may be that for the foreseeable future, Europe has to hold down the fort on key issues like fighting climate change, like free trade, like dealing in a humanitarian way with refugee flows, and then wait and see where the United States ends up after the midterms and after the next presidential election. I'm not suggesting that Europe is going to turn its back on the Trump administration, but I do think it will say, we're going to get on with these important international tasks. We continue to believe that there is a community of democracies out there. The door is open to Mr. Trump, and we hope he comes our way. And it's interesting that the new French president, Emmanuel Macron, invited Trump to come to the Bastille Day celebrations on July 14th in Paris. Trump has accepted. And so in some ways, what we see here is a Europe that will do what it thinks is necessary to keep the West together and at the same time reach out to Trump and hope that it can build a working relationship, even though it won't be easy.
Talking to Charles Kupchan, he's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Looking at President Trump's Europe trip, the G20 summit going on, the president expected to meet tomorrow with Russian President Vladimir Putin amid the backdrop of conflict here at home over Russia's role in last year's election. And let's turn to that point now, Charles. How much, no matter who the president is, how much does having this domestic turmoil related to a particular foreign power, in this case Russia, tie the hands of a president and his team when it comes to meeting and negotiating with that power?
Well, the president today did finally admit that, yeah, he thinks that the Russians did intervene, although he said, we never know. So he continues to cast doubt over the whole issue. But it does make it more difficult, and that's because there's a continuing swirl in Washington stemming from the Justice Department investigation, stemming from in congressional inquiries into exactly what the Russians did and what role, if any, the Trump campaign may have played in coaching, encouraging, colluding with the Russians. We simply don't know. There may be no connection. There may be a deep connection. But the fact that people are continuing to dig, they are continuing to wonder why Trump came into office so keen on building a bromance with Putin, does make many of us wonder what skeleton is in the closet. But that generally makes it hard for Trump to reach out to Putin at the meeting tomorrow, because people are always wondering, what's he up to? What does Putin have on Trump? Why, despite the fact that Putin has been such a tough customer, is Trump trying to make nice to him?
I want to get into the bigger picture of what's going on with international relations now. Getting back to that point of maybe we're moving away from this Atlantic community of democracies. You wrote about a transactional approach from the president, saying basically what's in it for the United States when it comes to trade or other negotiations. People point toward places like Turkey and the Philippines, where elected governments are moving toward a more authoritarian style. Are we seeing a really major fundamental shift in international politics now?
I don't think we have enough water under the bridge to answer that very important question. The fact that you are asking it and that many people are pondering it speaks volumes, because it does mean that it is conceivable that the era that opened up with Pearl Harbor, which is really the beginning of Pax Americana, that era could be coming to a close. And it could be coming to a close because the two countries most responsible for building that order, the United Kingdom and the United States, are unsure that they want to continue to support it. The UK has already voted to get out of the EU, one of the most advanced organizations, supranational bodies in the world. The United States has elected a president that seems ambivalent about globalization, that seems unsure whether he wants to continue to invest in a strong relationship with democratic allies. So we're going to have to wait and see. I do think, though, that Trump will find over time that the Atlantic democracies, whether he likes them or not, are the best friends that we have. And that's because when you call up the Chinese or the Indonesians or the Indians and the Brazilians and you say, are you going to send peacekeepers here? Are you prepared to send a field hospital to fight Ebola? What are you going to do about ISIL? Are you sending F-16s to bomb ISIL in Syria? They generally hang up the phone. When you call Europe, they don't necessarily give you everything that you want, but they try to step up to the plate. So even for a transactional president like Mr. Trump, I think over time, he will find that our European allies are still the best friends that we have in the world, and he may come back to them.
As we wrap up, a big question, should we, as the United States, continue to try to uphold stability around the world as we started to during and after World War II, or is it time for us to step back?
I think that President Trump is certainly on to something when he talks about our allies needing to share more of the burden. And I think we learned our lesson in Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan, that trying to turn such countries into Ohio or Wisconsin, for that matter, that's a bridge too far. And so I do think that the United States is going through a more programmatic shift to lighten its load. It started under Obama. It's continuing under Trump. But it needs to be handled very tactfully and very carefully. I think the U.S. needs to choose its fights carefully. That doesn't mean we should end our role as the provider of order, as the fireman if necessary, but it just does mean that we need to be careful that we don't expend ourselves in a place like Iraq or Afghanistan when we ought to be looking at the big picture, which is China, Russia, and making sure that global stability doesn't erode because there's nobody minding the store.
Charles, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Charles Kupchan, professor of international affairs at Georgetown University, looking at the president's visit to Europe.
Coming up after the news, we'll find out how science fiction could point the way to a more positive future. You're listening to Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Vera.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll learn about a new method being researched that might help reduce and potentially eradicate the proteins that cause chronic wasting disease in deer.
First, if you've watched science fiction movies and TV shows lately, or in the last 30 years or so for that matter, there's a good chance it painted a bleak image of the future.
You're going to be handmaids. You're going to serve God and your country.
You stay down by day. But at night you can move around. You still have to be careful because the HKs use infrared.
I volunteer! I volunteer as tribute.
I believe we have a volunteer.
Some dystopian visions of the future there from the world of science fiction, but the science fiction world isn't all gloom and doom. There are more positive visions of the future. And more planners and policymakers are trying to harness the power of science fiction by bringing together authors to create positive, realistic visions of the future.
Authors include big names like Elizabeth Baer, Bruce Starling, Neal Stephenson, Alistair Reynolds, Neil Gaiman, Margaret Atwood. The list goes on. Kevin Bankston joins us now for a look at the role of science fiction in creating a positive future. He is the director of New America's Open Technology Institute, and his piece on this topic is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Kevin, we heard a couple of examples there, from Hunger Games to The Handmaid's Tale and the classics like 1984, all these negative views of the future. Are we in more of a dystopian frame of mind lately?
somewhat, yes, if the bestseller lists are any indication. When the Trump inauguration happened, for example, George Orwell's surveillance and authoritarian dystopia in 1984 shot to the very top of Amazon's bestseller list, and that wasn't the only one. Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here, both sort of painting these portraits of authoritarian futures, both hit the top 20 that week. And meanwhile, one of the visions of the future that you shared at the front, The Handmaid's Tale, based on the book by Margaret Atwood, now a show on Hulu, has been a big hit. And I think this points to the fact that people, to some extent, try to process difficult times by looking to fiction depicting difficult times. Sometimes they look to history. Sometimes they look to the future. And they also use dystopias to sort of figure out how to recognize things that we want to avoid. There was a really funny, I thought, sign at the Women's March in January that said, "The Handmaid's Tale is not an instruction manual." Mm. But in a way, it is, because it signposts the kinds of things that we want to avoid.
So it's not. So you're not saying that Americans are more pessimistic about the state of the world necessarily, although they may be. You're saying that there could also be instructive things in these books, too.
Absolutely. But at the same time, we don't want to let the doom and gloom of The Handmaid's Tale or 1984 necessarily dictate what happens next. We also need to think about positive visions of the future. You know, so we can think about what we want to reach for rather than just what we want to avoid. And that's what this new project that y'all mentioned, which is called the Science Fiction Advisory Council, which just launched a few weeks ago, is trying to do. And to just describe what that is briefly, there's an organization called XPRIZE, which is a nonprofit that basically programs prizes trying to get people to make exponential progress on an issue. And so, for example, they're best known for having a multi-million-dollar prize for the first private company that successfully put a, you know, reusable suborbital spacecraft up in the air. But so what they've done is they brought together all these science fiction writers and some filmmakers, and are going to be working with them to build scenarios for positive visions of the future, starting with a collection that they just posted online at the website seat14c.com. I'll explain why they called it that in a minute. That's going to sort of paint a bunch of different pictures of positive futures set in the year 2037. And they're going to meet with these sci-fi writers quarterly. And through the insights of these writers, who think about the future all the time, usually from a well-informed place when it comes to what is coming technically, they're going to use that information to figure out what some of their next contests should be. Like, what are the big, you know, moonshot ideas they want to incentivize people to come up with in pursuit of these positive sci-fi futures that the writers are going to cook up for them?
And this isn't the only project doing this, trying to harness the power of science fiction. You were involved with one called the Hieroglyph Project, which also had science fiction authors creating positive visions. You write about others. There's a lot of this idea catching on out there.
Absolutely. I think the Hieroglyph Collection, organized by the folks at Arizona State University, came from Neal Stephenson, a big sci-fi writer, who's actually known for some pretty dark futures, coming out saying, "I think that science fiction is failing people by only focusing on dystopia. We need to come up with more positive visions." Hieroglyph was a part of that. This new advisory council is a part of that. Oh, and I promised to explain why the website is called Seat 14C. It's being co-sponsored by ANA, the luxury Japanese airline. And so the conceit for the collection is, you are on a flight from Tokyo to San Francisco in 2017, but then you are suddenly transported through a wormhole to 2037 and land in San Francisco in 2037. What does the world look like? And so you have all these science fiction writers writing about this future San Francisco from a variety of perspectives. And they also have invited readers to submit their own story, the story of the person in seat 14C. And the winner of that contest, the person who writes the best story, that is going to get published in the collection, and they'll also get a nice trip to Tokyo out of the deal.
Kevin Bengston is with us right now. He's director of New America's Open Technology Institute, and he's looking now at science fiction and the ways that it can influence the real world for the better. And Kevin, the real world has actually been a big influencer on some technology that started in science fiction, I should say, and made the jump to the real world. Can you give us some examples of that?
Sure. There's a really distinct feedback loop between science fiction and real technology, in part because so many people involved in technology are sci-fi nerds. And I say that as a proud sci-fi nerd myself, working in tech policy, in part based on the science fiction I read as a kid. But a few of the more common examples are Arthur C. Clarke, who wrote 2001. He actually came up with the idea of communication satellites in the 40s and then wrote about it in his fiction. A less famous sci-fi author named John Bruder predicted computer worms in the 70s. William Gibson, who wrote the cyberpunk classic Neuromancer, coined the term cyberspace. Star Trek, in addition to motivating an immeasurable number of people to pursue engineering careers, also was one of the inspirations for the first cell phone, based on the communicators in the show. And then there are even weirder stories, like, for example, the film War Games, which depicts young Matthew Broderick as a hacker who hacks into the computers that control nuclear weapons in the early 80s. That kind of inspired Congress to pass our first computer crime law, and it really freaked Reagan out. Apparently Ronald Reagan saw the movie and then went to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and said, "Can this happen?" And they were like, kind of. Meanwhile, Congress is holding hearings on this issue on the Hill, literally opening hearings with clips from the movie War Games, which, was set in the present, but was definitely science fiction. It involved, an artificial intelligence that ran all the nuclear wargaming. And then there are things like, say, Steven Spielberg's Minority Report movie based on the Philip K. Dick novel. What a lot of people remember from that is the user interface, the sort of gestural computer interface that Tom Cruise uses, and that has influenced not only real interface design, but also has been, now imitated in practically every sci-fi movie since.
So what's the benefit of, not just being inspired by an entertaining science fiction book or TV show or movie, but actually setting out as an exercise with some of the pros in the profession and trying to chart a course to a positive near-term future?
Because it helps you embody ideas in a narrative, which makes it easier to really understand the implications of the technologies we're talking about. A good example of this is a project at the think tank, the Atlantic Council, which actually did a project around the future of war, commissioning short stories from sci-fi writers while also inviting short stories through a contest, often submitted by warfighters themselves, like people in the military trying to conceptualize the future of war. And there's just something about narrative that allows us to engage with new ideas in a constructive way. And science fiction does this better than anything else. Like, it is a genre of fiction that is exclusively built around the idea of grappling with the tensions and the promise and the peril of new technology and how it impacts society. Not to name any names, but there's actually a pretty serious, there is a field of people who do this kind of sci-fi prototyping, writing scenarios about technologies for companies. It's a job, like legit, like people actually write sci-fi for internal use at tech companies. And I was talking to one of these practitioners who wrote some stories about some of the negative uses of the AI technology that this one company was building. And when they presented these stories, these dark futures based on this company's technologies in the boardroom, one of the engineers had to go home to process it. He'd never really thought about the negative implications of the cool stuff they were building. And so it really gives you a visceral grasp of what lived experience is going to be in the future with these technologies that a white paper or bullet point talking points are not going to give you.
Kevin Bankston is with us. He's director of New America's Open Technology Institute. We're talking about science fiction and the ways it can influence the real world, possibly for the better.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is there a science fiction book or a movie or a TV show that you think paints a positive, inspiring picture of the future? And how do you see science fiction influencing the real world? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about science fiction's influence on the real world's future, as a number of different groups are bringing science fiction writers on board to lay out positive visions for the years to come. Kevin Bankston is with us. He's director of New America's Open Technology Institute.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever read or watched something, science fiction, and thought, I want to live there? Or it would be cool if we could do that one thing, or we need to prevent this from happening in the real world. Do you think there's potential here to use science fiction to plot a course for our future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Linda on the line in Gurnee, Illinois. Linda, hi.
Hi. This is really interesting and unique. The movie that I saw that I felt I was hoping it would make an impact is The Martian.
Mm-hmm.
And not that it provides you an optimistic view, but it's very relevant and timely because it shows in the not too distant future where we could be if we don't stop pummeling the environment. And it was really, I thought some of the sort of subtle things that they showed in the movie, such as somebody's farm field just catching fire just all on its own, was really good visuals. And I was hoping that it would really perk up some people that are still pummeling the environment.
Linda, thank you for that. And I'm trying to remember that scene for The Martian, or if she's thinking of Interstellar. I'm not sure. But some good lessons from both of those, for sure. Kevin, it's fun to get into some of these examples. What do you think about what Linda was saying there?
Sure. I mean, yeah, I don't remember any environmental themes in The Martian. I do remember them in Interstellar. But The Martian is a great example of the kind of sci-fi that simply by being a ripping good yarn and not shying away from the science can inspire young people to actually get into science, to think about things like, I could go work for NASA. It also helps NASA inspire policymakers to continue to fund it. And it's perhaps not a coincidence that you know, last year Congress approved a budget for NASA to do Mars missions. I think that putting that kind of work in an inspiring way in front of the public helps keep that hope alive of our future in space.
Linda, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Kevin, with technology now changing so quickly, it can feel like we're always following in the wake and dealing with the consequences after the fact. Could efforts like these, you know, having science fiction authors try to think things through at the outset, help us get a little further ahead of the impacts of new technology?
Absolutely. I think science fiction can be a really great laboratory for testing out different approaches to how we're going to adapt to new technologies. Although I also don't want to, I also want to emphasize that looking to the past of science fiction can also be helpful. You know, for example, we're all grappling with what AI is going to do to our society, and it's a really complex, fraught issue. And so naturally, we're reaching for science fiction to help us conceptualize the threat and the promise. And yet, in part because not enough people read a lot of science fiction, we keep reaching to a few things that everybody mostly knows, those things being HAL 9000, the evil AI from 2001, Isaac Asimov's Three Laws of Robotics about how robots should behave and not hurt people, and one last one. I'll let y'all guess this last one.
Frankenstein?
Skynet from Terminator.
Oh, Terminator. I even played a clip earlier.
The evil AI that kills all of humanity. And yet, there are countless brilliant science fiction authors who have tried to address questions of AI ethics in science fiction over the decades. We just haven't really deliberately tried to mine the good ideas out of all that old science fiction. And so if I had all the time and the money in the world, you know, one of the first things I do is hire some grad students to help, like, do a survey of science fiction's treatment of that topic and see what useful ideas we can get out of it beyond Skynet and Asimov's Three Laws.
And Kevin, just super briefly, because we've got some folks waiting to talk to you, what's changed that we're taking sci-fi writers and science fiction itself seriously today?
Well, you know, you tell me. We live in an era of drones and self-driving cars and supercomputers in our pockets. that are also happen to be spying on us. Like, we are facing a level of exponential technological change unlike anything else in human history. And the only thing that is readily available to give us the cognitive tools to try and cope with that as a culture is science fiction.
Talking to Kevin Bankston from New America's Open Technology Institute, looking at efforts by science fiction authors and others to create positive visions as maybe roadmaps for humans' near-term future. I'll go back to our callers with Taj in Monona, Iowa. Taj, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to bring up?
Well, that lady was definitely talking about Interstellar with the crops and everything, but one point that I thought was really interesting, theoretically speaking, from that movie was the level of involvement of AI in agriculture. I'm living in Iowa, and, you know, we've got agriculture going on all around us and more automation, you know, self-guided tractors and everything. And that's definitely going to change the future of agriculture in America, I think, with the level of AI involvement and automation and the elimination of human involvement in the growing of our food crops.
Taj, thank you so much for bringing that up, Kevin. I've talked to farmers on this show, you know, and you think farming and rustic, and they're talking about drones and computerized moisture sensors and things like this. Technology is affecting us in ways that isn't readily apparent maybe to a lot of people who don't work in special fields.
Yeah, I mean, it's just another example of how I don't want to say no one is safe, because the technology brings a lot of benefits too, but like, no one is immune to the massive changes that technology is bringing to practically every field of human endeavor, and farming is no different.
Taj, thanks a lot for that call, and we're going to go next to Diane in Galena, Illinois. Diane, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I was calling was on the movie probably that made a big impact in my life was a movie from the late 1990s. It was called Deep Impact. It was with Tia Lanoni.
Right.
Are you familiar with it?
I vaguely remember it. Kevin, do you remember that one?
Well, it came out the same year as Armageddon.
Armageddon, that's the one I remember.
They were both the sort of planet-killing asteroid movies.
Well, I thought was, when looking back on it, are the countries around the world, do we have a plan, an actual plan of what were to happen if there was an asteroid that was that would explode over the world? And what decision is our government going to make and how to handle it?
Diane, thanks for bringing that up. And beyond sending Bruce Willis to blow it up, what do we do, Kevin?
I have a funny story regarding Armageddon, not Deep Impact, but Armageddon, which is there was a young man who was in college at the time and saw that movie, and he didn't know what he wanted to do with his life. And then he saw that movie, and the next day he enrolled in engineering to focus on how to make make humanity a multi-planet species, so that if we ever lost this planet, we'd still survive. And now he's one of the VPs at Elon Musk's space startup, which I'm forgetting the name of it for the moment.
SpaceX, right?
Yes, SpaceX. And so that's someone who very directly was inspired by a movie similar to the one that the caller mentioned to go into literally building our future in space.
Kevin, I don't want to get out of this conversation talking about positive images in science fiction without talking a little more about Star Trek, one of the most seen bits of science fiction out there and noted for a lot of positive views of where humanity is going. Is that a starting point where today's writers could take inspiration in different directions?
Absolutely. I think a lot of people in the real world, putting aside writers, have taken inspiration from Star Trek in a wide variety of ways, especially a lot of people inspired to go into technology or go into working around space stuff. The problem with Star Trek is that exactly how its utopia worked was always very vague, but it was basically, you know, we have conquered need, you know, it's a post-scarcity society where everyone's needs are taken care of, and they've conquered war, and they sort of just resolved, you know, human conflict as a thing. I'm not sure how one does that, and Star Trek never quite painted a roadmap for that. But simply as an ideal, as a utopia, it's an inspiring one and a nice antidote to some of the darker features that can make you sort of despair for the future.
Well, Kevin, it's a brave new world. Thanks a lot for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Kevin Bankston, director of New America's Open Technology Institute. His piece on science fiction and the real world future is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
And you can share your favorite science fiction books, TV shows, and movies, ones that had a positive view of the future, something you saw was inspiring, or something more negative and frightening that you hope we can avoid as a species. Again, read Kevin's piece and share your favorite or most scary bits of science fiction over at the Central Time Facebook page. Summerfest is going on now in Milwaukee, and lots of performers are giving it their all. And it turns out one performer gave a bit too much.
The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported yesterday that British singer-songwriter Barnes Courtney broke his foot during an act over the weekend. How did he do this? He leapt off the stage without first making sure that there was a crowd there to catch him.
Looks like he's rolling with it like a rock star. He's had tweets and Facebook posts showing the incident and the aftermath, including the hashtag, jumping off stage was the best idea I had all month.
He posted that he would do a scheduled show last night in Los Angeles, but quote, there will be less stage diving.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if he does this all the time, the jumping off stage. And in theory, when you're stage diving, you're diving and people are catching you. Yeah.
You're a musician. Is this what happens with your sold out shows in the arenas that you play?
No, I would not count on enough bodies there to soak up the sound, much less catch me. But on the upside, we play in such lower end places. Usually there's not a stage. So it's just if I jump, it's all at the same level.
You know, it would be exciting without the breaking the foot part. I like the idea.
We'll go to the news with Fire by Barnes Courtney here on Central Time.